Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and get started with the Senate Judiciary Committee, so I'll call it to order. This morning, we have a number of bills that are up for public hearing. We had some carryovers, and I want to apologize to individuals that will be testifying today publicly. Yesterday, we had an oversight as we were working off of a list that had been compiled from the registration of witnesses. Unfortunately, a couple of names did not make that list. Because of that, we asked them to come back at their convenience. Fortunately for us, they were able to come back today. And what we're going to go ahead and do is take their testimony to complete the testimony that was should have been taken yesterday. So at this point, I'm going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on the following three bills. House Bill 2787A, House Bill 2792A, House Bill 2797A, as well as the three concepts that we were also asking for input regarding guns on public school grounds, restoration of privileges for persons convicted of felonies, as well as access to firearms for persons suffering from mental health issues. With that, we'll open up those public hearings. What I'm going to do is I'm going to go ahead and ask Mr. Pate and Mr. Lucas, if you two both will come up. I've told both the gentlemen, because of the oversight that we made yesterday, coming back to the Capitol, that they would each have 5 minutes, which is greater than what we were able to accommodate prior. And so at this point, and Mr. Lucas was given the opportunity to, use his time or waive his time to his wife, who already had given some previous testimony. So I'm not sure who wants to go first, if the Lucases or the Pate.
Mr. Chair, if I could briefly interrupt.
Yes.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'd just like to add my public apology to the apologies been made. I've already spoken directly to Mr. Lucas and Mr. Pate both. The error was entirely mine, and the inconvenience that it's caused everybody, not just the chair and the members of this committee, but the larger members of the Senate body, their offices, their staffs, the folks regularly appearing on bills already scheduled who were bumped the past couple of days. Mr. Chair, you've been very gracious in your description of the error. I compiled the list that he used yesterday that omitted your names entirely by accident, and would also like to apologize.
Cheyenne, thank you very much, but you didn't need to do that. I'm the chair. I get paid the big bucks, so it falls here. So thank you very much, and we'll hear from the Lucases first.
Thank you. My name is Dan Lucas, and I'm from Beaverton, and I'm here to testify against the concept of prohibiting law-abiding CHL holders from carrying in schools. Last Thursday, a number of education bureaucrats and union lobbyists testified about how they have worked very hard to send a message that schools are safe places and that they have a zero-tolerance gun policy on school grounds. These individuals are clearly out of touch with the reality facing teachers in Oregon. Messages and policies don't stop real criminals. My older daughter is a fourth-grade teacher right here in Salem. She's been teaching at her school for 3 years now. In that time, she's had a stalker from the neighborhood get all the way into her classroom right at the end of a school day. Thankfully, he didn't attempt to harm her, but if he had, she would have been completely defenseless. So despite the message that schools are safe, the reality is that they're not always safe. Within a year of the stalker incident, there was a gang-related shooting at her school on the school grounds on a Saturday. A gang member who had been released from prison had brought his gun into a gun-free school zone and shot another gang member. There were teachers working inside the building who were defenseless, who couldn't get to their cars. Thankfully, the gang member didn't target the teachers, but it showed the gun-free policy did nothing to deter the criminal. Criminals don't care about messages and policies. As a result of these incidents, my daughter no longer stays after school. My daughter no longer works on the weekends because she doesn't feel safe. I strongly urge the committee to give my daughter the chance to defend herself. I urge the committee to consider the expert testimony of the 90 years of law enforcement who stated that law-abiding CHL holders are not the problem. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Rachel Lucas. In 2004 in Beslan, Russia, Islamic terrorists attacked a secondary school. Police arriving on the scene were too late, and 186 children were dead. Not long after that, an Iraqi insurgent was found with blueprints and security information for six schools in the U.S. One of those six schools is right here in Salem, Oregon, where our daughter teaches. As my husband said, our daughter's a fourth grade teacher, and recently one of the school's public safety officers came to train them what to do in case of an attack. Although he trained them to keep the children very quiet, it was clear that this would be tragically insignificant in the face of a real attack. College's campuses, I'd like to address that. They cover large areas, and students often take classes at night. Both our daughters attended Western Oregon University, and despite the school's safety policy, there were two serial rapists who were finally arrested and are now in jail, but not before attacking several students. One of them was the daughter of one of our friends. She's still traumatized, and her life will never be the same. She still props a chair up under the doorknob at night in her bedroom. For her 25th birthday, her parents bought her a handgun, but she's afraid to get her CHL because she doesn't want anyone, especially her attacker, to have access to information about her. In Nevada, Amanda Collins, a CHL holder, was raped at gunpoint because guns were not allowed on campus. And a rapist went on to murder a 19-year-old girl soon after. But Amanda says that had she been allowed to carry her gun, she would not have been raped and the young woman would not be dead. Her main argument comes from self-protection, that everyone deserves a chance to defend themselves. The criminals who are intent on committing a crime don't care what the rules and regulations are. Of the 70 schools that allow students and faculty with permits to carry guns, not one has been involved in a firearm incident or crime. Perhaps those of us who have been violated and have faced death do not have illusions about safety measures and gun-free zones. We have what my training instructor and Iraq vet calls combat instincts. It's why I'm still here today. But I was lucky. I was only beaten and raped. I'm still alive. My rapist is in prison, and when he's out on parole, he assaults other women. It's something that I and my family have to live with, and it never goes away. And perhaps that's why I don't have illusions. I have combat instincts. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Pate.
Yes, sir. Thank you. I would like to say something personally. It's oftentimes something will happen public and the apology will come in private. When it comes in a public venue like this, I cannot tell you how much I appreciate that and how and the graciousness for rescheduling us. I really appreciate that. Thank you very much on that. Again, my name is Dan Pate. I am the president of the Oregon State Shooting Association, the vice chair of the State Range Association. I sit on the board of directors for the National Shooting Sports Foundation. I'm also a competitor on one of the U.S. teams and a former law enforcement officer for a number of years. And I currently train law enforcement officers across this country and Canada, and to a lesser degree for our military. First, I'd like to speak on the subject of banning firearms in school. And I don't want to just focus on concealed carry holders. I want to talk about firearms, because there's many aspects of this that perhaps we're not thinking about or haven't thought about the end ramifications. Banning firearms in schools would have absolutely no positive effect on security, as you've already heard. There has never been an instance in particular of a concealed carry holder causing a problem in a school. There has been the inverse, and I'll get to that in a moment. Despite the testimony we heard yesterday, I got online, tried to find the instance of the three concealed carry holders that had caused homicides. They appear to be non-existent. I've looked. I've diligently looked on and had friends of mine look on the PIN network. It doesn't seem to exist out there. Banning firearms in schools would actually make campuses less safe. To look at this, you have to go no further than recent history, the Columbine High School, West Virginia Tech, and the other examples like that. In the Columbine School, we had two students took firearms that they could not legally possess, took them to school and killed many students. What ended that was those students committing suicide. In the West Virginia Tech example, we had a foreign national, I believe he had his immigration cards and everything, had taken two, I might add, illegal firearms to a school, and in two different instances killed 32 people, wounded 29 others. If you compare this example with the Appalachian School of Law, where another individual brought firearms onto campus, he killed two people. What stopped that incident was two people there that had concealed firearms were able to stop the incident in a moment. If I can't help but think in this example that what would have happened if somebody that was a concealed carry holder had been at those schools, at not just Columbine. Columbine was a high school, but West Virginia Tech. If they had been allowed to have a firearm on campus, West Virginia Tech is a gun-free campus, much as what I'm hearing we're trying to, or is being tried to propose here. Concealed carry holders are not the problem. They are your, while they are not vigilantes and they're not law enforcement officers, they are people that have taken the time to get the training and the skill set to protect not only their own lives, but potentially the lives of others. In the last 10 years, every case of school shootings on campus that has been stopped abruptly has been stopped with somebody with a concealed carry firearm. That's you can look that up. Another aspect that hasn't been considered here, I do not believe in reading some of the previous testimony, is the effect that this is going to have on safety of youth. Where that comes in is as it relates to Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. In conversations with members of the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, this would be devastating to their programs of youth safety and hunters education in the forest. To get more information, we don't have time to go into all that, but there's many schools in Oregon where hunter safety and hunter ed is taught after hours. We have currently approximately 24 to 26 gun ranges, member gun ranges, that have hunter safety and hunter's education taught on their campus. This represents a small but significant portion of that. Schools bring up the balance. I asked for the numbers. They were not readily available. They're supposed to get that to me. If you like, I can send that in, if anybody be interested in that information. As it relates to ODF and W, it would severely curtail the amount of classes they'd be able to teach. The next thing I'd like to speak on is House Bill 2787, making concealed carry licenses confidential. This, by its very nature, I believe, is self-explanatory. There's many, we can make arguments, we can go on both sides of this, but as public figures, I'm sure you're aware of that, you probably have less security or less anonymity than many of us. But how much more would you be exposed? How much more would each of us be exposed if our personal information was put out there for everyone to see? And I can speak as a police officer. If I, as a concealed carry holder, am known to have a concealed license, I can now become a target. I can be successfully attacked and harmed. As if you're not known, then there's always that anonymity. You're not the target. And that's a key. Concealed carry, by its very nature, is supposed to be concealed and unknown. The next thing I'd like to talk about is House Bill 2792, giving concealed carry license permission from non-residents to carry in the state of Oregon. I travel with my position on the U.S. team, and as a competitive shooter, I travel literally across the country and into Canada. Now, of course, you can't carry concealed carry firearms into Canada because their laws. It is my responsibility when I travel from this state to any other state to know the laws of that state and to obey those laws. I would expect the same requirements for anybody traveling to the state of Oregon. Not all states may meet the requirements for the state of Oregon, but I believe it's a step in the right direction to open up for licensed concealed carriers from other states to carry here in the state of Oregon. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Let me see if there's any questions from anyone. I do have a question, I think, for anyone on the panel regarding none of you addressed the issues about mental health issues and individuals having access. I think Mr. Pate may know this. I'm not sure if the Lucases know. I know of two officers who were killed in the line of duty. I believe both of those individuals were killed by individuals who had extensive mental health issues. One of them I know, at least the one that I worked with, and as a prosecutor, the individual did go through the background check, did come through with a clean check before she was able to buy a gun at retail. Mm-hmm. Do any of you have any positions or perspectives of what you think this committee should or shouldn't do as it pertains to individuals that have mental health issues and access to guns?
Yes, sir, absolutely. I wanted to touch on it, but I knew I was running into time, and I didn't want to
Well, now
you use
the question, so you can take a little more.
Yes. On the mental health issue, I'm a veteran. I'm a combat veteran. I'm a disabled veteran. And after I got hurt, I spent approximately a year and a half in the hospital getting back on my feet, learning how to walk again and doing all that. And it was extremely, extremely trying. And in my case, I didn't at that time have the opportunity or felt I had the opportunity to talk to anyone about the issues that I was dealing with. That is even exacerbated further today, where we have military repeatedly in combat zones serving additional tours of duty. The assumption is, and this is not just one assumption, but the assumption is if you talk to somebody about issues you have, that you're violent or that you have the potential to be violent. I would offer that everyone has the potential to be violent. Who is to a greater or lesser degree? As the lady testified yesterday, the assumption that when somebody has a mental illness or needs some help or wants to talk with somebody, that they're violent is fairly erroneous. It is erroneous. As I understand this is written, if a veteran or somebody with a mental illness goes to somebody for counseling and help, that they will be probably banned from carrying concealed or owning firearms or anything like that. I would encourage caution, especially from my veteran side. I know that everybody goes through times, all of us do, but when you've been through a traumatic situation, whether it's a rape, whether it's getting injured, wounded, whatever, it would help to have somebody to talk to for a while, somebody that you can relate to. So I really exercise caution in voting for some bill that would just arbitrarily ban that.
All right, thank you. If y'all have any comments, we'll take it. If not, thank y'all very much for coming back again.
Thank you.
Thank you again. I really appreciate it.
You bet. All right, so we're going to go ahead and close the public hearings on those three bills, 2787, 2792, 2797, as well as on the conceptual concepts that were mentioned earlier. And at this point, we're going to go ahead and start the remainder of our public hearings that we have scheduled for today. And let's see. We are going to move that. Aaron's here, but Bill's not. So Aaron, why don't you come on up? We'll go ahead and do that, and Bill will probably get back because that's his bill. Okay, so why don't we go ahead and do, let's do bill in order, let's do 2696. All right, so I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2696.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, House Bill 2696 affects the sale of scrap metal. Specifically, it adds to the definition of commercial seller and to the statute generally nonprofit corporations. Right now, they do not exist in the statutory language affecting the sale of scrap metal, which is causing problems for scrap metal sellers. It also modifies the methods in which a check can be delivered and allows law enforcement to sort of approve certain sellers who then would be exempt from some of the general mailing requirements where payment is concerned.
All right, thank you. Thomas?
Yes.
If you'll give us your name, and since I don't have it written down, if you'd be so kind to spell your last name so we'll make sure we get it down.
Sure. For the record, my name's Thomas Cuomo, C-U-O-M-O, and I'm the legislative assistant for Representative Olson. Unfortunately, he couldn't be here this morning, so I'm here to convey his thoughts on a couple of his bills. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this bill, House Bill 2696, comes to you from the House side, where it's passed 58-0. If you recall, we passed a major metal theft bill, Senate Bill 570, during the 2009 session, in which you, Mr. Chair, were deeply involved. House Bill 2696 addressed two small concerns that were brought to my attention from the metal recycling industry that needed to be fixed. During the interim, I met with three members of the law enforcement community and the recycling industry. This is what the two problems are. First, if an individual collected scrap metal from a neighborhood in an effort to give the proceeds to an organization like Eugene Mission or Albany Helping Hands or some other nonprofit organization with the intent to have the scrap metal business forward the check to the nonprofit, the business was prohibited from doing so, mainly because the check could only be sent to the individual selling the scrap metal. Second, scrap metal dealers have many checks returned to them due to a wrong address or an individual who has moved. This creates a problem for the business that follows good business practices by delivering the check to the customer. On occasion, when the customer contacts the business requesting the check, the business has no option but to obtain an address and mail the check again. This has caused additional administrative work for the scrap metal dealers and caused some serious angst for customers. In fact, some customers would rather take the metal to the dump rather than hassle with recycling. House Bill 2696 fixes both of these problems. The measure allows a scrap metal dealer to mail a non-transferable check to a nonprofit organization, and it allows a direct release of a check to an individual or nonprofit organization if they're able to obtain written authorization from a respective law enforcement agency. This would allow for a faster transition between scrap metal businesses and customers who have been sufficiently vetted by law enforcement. I urge you to move this bill to the Senate floor. Thank you.
All right, so Thomas, let me just see if there's any questions on this. I do want to just get clarification, and I hate to put you on the spot, so if I do, just tell me and we'll get through this. The second part that it fixes would provide for or allow for the customer who has gone through some type of, I'm going to say, review or perspective with law enforcement to get some type of ability to have a check issued to them directly at the time of the transaction?
I can speak to that.
I'm afraid I don't.
We'll go for, no, the, life. We'll go for the answer. Line.
Okay.
And Chair Pozanski, members of the committee, that portion is at page 3, line 13. Basically what it says is if law enforcement gives written authorization to an individual or a nonprofit corporation, then they can sort of bypass the otherwise existing mailing requirement. The testimony that was given by Representative Olson as a circumstance under which that might take place is a lot of these scrap metal businesses are seeing the same customers over and over and over, and like any business, they build a relationship with those customers, get to know those customers. Some of those individuals may be transient and have difficulty receiving mail. It doesn't mean they're not reliable in terms of where they're getting the mail or where they're getting the metal. And if law enforcement signs off on it, clear criminal history, no history of illegal scrapping, it really cuts down on the paperwork in terms of getting these checks bounced.
And then the follow-up to that, is there some requirement for those records to be kept by either the metal industry recycler or with the law enforcement or both?
Okay. Chair Pozanski,
bearing with me.
Members of the committee, that question actually was raised on the House side, I believe, by Representative Nolan, and there is no provision in the bill as written that I am aware of that says anything beyond written law enforcement. It's a written approval of a law enforcement agency having jurisdiction over the scrap metal business. So there's no then subsequent definition of whether there would be a custodian, whether the person who had the account would be responsible for having this with them, whether the scrap metal business would keep it, or whether law enforcement would keep it. I suppose those are all possibilities, but there's no clarification.
Okay. Any other questions or comments on this particular bill? Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on House Bill 2696? Not seeing one, we'll go ahead and close the public hearing. Stay right there, Thomas. We're going to go ahead and open up, since you're already at the dais, House Bill 3128.
Oops. Chair Pozanski, members of the committee, House Bill 3128 affects individuals who wish to terminate suspension or revocation of their driving privileges by voluntarily surrendering their driving privileges.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3128 comes to you from the House side of the building where it passed unanimously 60-0. This bill is pretty simple. It comes at a time when one's life, due to mental or physical impairments, that they are no longer capable of operating a motor vehicle safely. In many cases, a personal doctor may notify DMV of the impairment, causing the person's driving privileges to be suspended.
Thomas, I need you to go ahead and put your name on the record again for this particular bill.
I apologize. For the record, my name is Thomas Cuomo. I'm a legislative assistant with Representative Olson. In many cases, a personal doctor may notify the DMV of the impairment, causing the person's driving privileges to be suspended, or it may be due to the individual failing to submit to an examination. Regardless of the circumstance, the person's driving status is listed as suspended. This is where the problem occurs. Occasionally, an insurance company will cancel a couple's policy when they learn of the family member's driving status as suspended. This happened to a family in Albany last year. The couple had been with the particular insurance company for over 30 years when the husband lost his license due to a physical impairment, and his status became suspended, and the insurance company canceled their coverage. Eventually, it was restored, but the problem still exists. I appreciate the help from members of ODOT and DMV who helped me craft this bill. With this bill, should the same situation occur, the family member can go to the DMV, surrender the driver's license voluntarily, and their driver's license will be listed as no driver's license. This status is treated entirely different from insurance agencies and police. There is no fiscal impact of this bill, and I urge you to move this bill to the Senate floor. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Questions, Senator
Winstead? Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there any process for reinstatement of the person who surrenders their licenses and recovers? I'm thinking if you had advanced cataracts, you didn't have them treated, you couldn't see well enough to drive, then you had your cataracts treated, you would be then, is there a method here? Would you have to start over again, or is there a method to have your license reinstated once it's been surrendered?
That's a good question. I don't know.
Why don't we'll try to get information on that. I would assume that since they had a record, that you might just have to go through a reinstatement process. And if it's for medical, they may require some type of a testing to make sure you are eligible. But I would hope that they wouldn't make you go through a complete set of tests. And it looks like we have someone here standing to give us a lifeline from the, gallery. ODOT is here for the rescue.
Where's your great white horse?
Yeah. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, ODOT is here. Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation, Driver and Motor Vehicle Services Division. Actually, the answer is, Senator Whitsitt, that if a person surrenders their driver license and then decides they think they're in a situation where they could again resume driving, they would indeed have to start over the entire process to regain a license, because at that point they have no driver license anymore.
And if we could follow up, it makes sense. Is that in the perspective that since they've surrendered it, we basically say, you know, that contract, or not the contract, but the privilege has been given up, and so and there's no time frame? In other words, if they came in the following day and said, wait a second, I want to do this, they'd have to start all over, or is there a period of time that lapses before they lose that ability to, or say, we can't?
Chair Przanski, this is a new situation, obviously, with the bill, but there currently is a provision in the law where a person could, without having been turned in by their doctor, just decide, and this does happen, that they no longer really should be driving, and they come in and turn in their license. They're given a free identification card called a QDID. At that point, you have surrendered your driver license completely voluntarily, and if you want to regain it, you do need to start over.
Okay.
And presumably that will have been done with, the giving up of the license will have been done with some consideration at that point.
And then the other part of this, I guess I just want to follow up to make sure clarity, if you had a doctor or police officer, you can also have someone, let's say, petition for retesting the individual. They are basically just required to come in and demonstrate that they are still able to operate safely and within the guidelines. So long as they are able to do that, then they basically get their license. I guess it wouldn't be reinstated. They maintain it, or does it go? Do they lose it and, with some type of notice? They have a right to appeal or to come forward. Can you explain that to us?
Sure, I'll do my best, Chair Przanski. So if an officer turned in the form that says this person really should be retested, the person is given 60 days to come in and take the appropriate test. During that time, they have completely normal driving privileges. If the person fails to come in, then after the 60 days, they are suspended, and then they can have a hearing after that. If the person does come in and tests and demonstrates that they should not be driving, they can't pass the test, they're suspended at that point as well. And then from the at-risk medical provision, when the doctor turns in that document that says, you know, my patient, Mr. Smith, should no longer be driving because of X and such situation, they can that can be reviewed by a DMV employee called a medical determination officer, who's a physician employed by DMV, who can review that information and make a determination whether that is so or not, and then testing can proceed from there as well with hearing rights.
Okay. Other questions? Senator Romici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wonder if on the House side, or if Senator, or excuse me, Representative Olson heard anything from the insurance companies, because typically insurance is risk-based, and it doesn't really change anything if the person is labeled as suspended or no driver's license. It's still the same person. They're still in the same family. And according to your testimony, what happened was that the couple's policy was, the family's policy was suspended because the license was suspended. So it doesn't really change. It's still the same person, whether they have something that said they were suspended or something that says that they had no driver's license. So did the insurance companies weigh in on this at all? Did they seem to care?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I don't know for sure, but I'd imagine that he had been touching base with a couple insurance agencies in the area, and obviously the one in this situation. And I think it was just a situation where they both had their driver's licenses, and then when the one got suspended, it, you know, caused some suspicion there, and that's kind of where they went with this.
And if I may, Chair Przanski and Senator Bonamici, right, no one from the insurance industry testified at the hearing, but I know from working with Representative Olson since before session on this bill that he was in communication with the insurance industry, and my understanding is when they pull a person's record and it shows suspended, things happen, and if the box that or the report comes back no driver license as opposed to suspended, it just kind of goes into a different system from their perspective.
All right, any other questions, comments? All right, thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on House Bill 3128? Not seeing anyone, I'll go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 3128, and I'm willing to open up a work session on this one if we're ready to go forward. All right. I'm going to open up a work session on House Bill 3128.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3128 to the floor to be passed recommendation.
All right. Senator Cruz moves House Bill 3128 to the floor to be passed recommendation. Any discussion? Well, I had a discussion, but unfortunately, Thomas has now left. Golly. I was, you know, this letterhead. I'm wondering how Representative Olson got Ramona to sign off on bold print for his last name, a different font for his first name. Well, and then he uses a happy face.
That's a happy face.
Where, how do you...
Do we need to enter that into the record, the happy face?
Yeah, I mean, the happy face is, you know, I don't know if that's a legitimate key on the computer.
I don't have a happy face key on my computer.
Yours is, yeah, yours is the other.
A frowning face.
I set myself up for that.
You did. Okay.
Quite all right. All right, so any other comments?
Oh, wait, he's back.
Oh, you are back.
You just missed the senatorial humor, which is really low.
We just want to make sure that Representative Olson hears back from the committee. I brought up the fact that I was wondering how he got past, slipped past Ramona. His font that he used on his letterhead, having a bold print for Olson, Andy being a different font, and then we're really kind of perplexed as to him having a happy face on his computer keys.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure if you text often with Representative Olson, but he's becoming quite savvy with LOL and happy faces and stuff like that, and I'll leave it to you to talk to him about it.
Well, and I'll just say that Senator Cruz said he didn't have that on there, so we just assumed he had a frown on his. So.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So we put frowning faces on.
Gotcha. Well, make sure you hold it right side up or it could look
all right. Thank you for coming back to deliver the message.
I will.
All right. Any other discussion on House Bill 3128? Any objection to the motion? So ordered. And let's see, the chair will carry House Bill 3128 to the floor.
With a happy face.
Thanks for bearing with me.
You bet. And if you could just on the, I'll just go ahead and put this on the record regarding House Bill 2696, which we heard earlier. I want to talk to the representative regarding maintaining some type of record of the law enforcement giving approval, because I could see where someone else could come in depending on what law enforcement agency delivered it or gave it to the individual, and someone else coming in. They're not anything on record to cross over, so I just want to make sure we don't set up an unintended consequence.
Mr. Chair, and exploring that is fine. Let's just not set up something that's too bureaucratic and onerous in the process.
No, I figured if you have an account with this person, they could stick the letter with the account.
Yeah.
All right. So with that, let's see. We have one other bill to hear today, and that's House Bill, I believe it is 3128. So I'll open up a... 3021. House Bill 3021.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, House Bill 3021 would modify the Department of Justice's Crime Victims Compensation Program in a few ways. First of all, it modifies the period of time for filing an application for compensation. Secondly, it modifies the availability of post-conviction counseling benefits.
All right, great. I have three people who signed up: Shannon Savelle, Cynthia Stinson, and Sybil Hebb. Why don't the three of you come up? And while they're coming up, is there anyone else who will want to give testimony on House Bill 3021A?
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Shannon Savelle from the Department of Justice. The Department of Justice has had a crime victims compensation program for over 30 years. The program essentially provides financial assistance to victims of crime so that they can cope with the financial consequences of things like counseling, medical bills, and loss of pay. What HB 3021, the A-engrossed version, proposes to do is to make three simple changes to the bill. The first one is to provide that victims who apply for compensation have a full year after they've suffered the injury in order to apply. Currently, it's only 6 months, and we find typically that, not typically, but in many cases, a victim or survivor is having to cope with the court system. They have injuries, they're traumatized, and it's difficult to try to expect them to then cope with filling out paperwork so that they can actually manage these expenses as well within a six-month period. The second piece, it provides victims greater access to counseling benefits when the offender is going through post-conviction appeals processes. And the third piece is a clarification on the one on the caps, which is $20,000 a victim can receive for medical benefits, but also the A-engrossed version provides additional flexibility there so that if a victim can show that they have suffered a catastrophic injury, the caps are in fact more flexible and they can receive more compensation. Cynthia Stinson is actually the director of our Crime Victim Services Division. Her division administers this program, and so she can answer all your in-depth questions and probably provide you with a bit of more in-depth background.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Cynthia Stinson. I'm the director of the Crime Victim Services Division with the Oregon Department of Justice. And I will just add the $20,000 cap is for reimbursement of medical and counseling expenses. As Shannon said, all of our payments out to victims are reimbursements only. So victims have to show that they have incurred crime-related injuries, and then we reimburse them for those. But as Shannon explained, the other provisions are really to allow more victims to have more access to the program in a meaningful way. I'm happy to answer any questions that you have.
All right, thank you. And Sybil, why don't you give your testimony?
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center, also in support of House Bill 3021A. As you know, the Law Center provides services to low-income people. The impact of crimes, the aftermath of dealing with crime, whether medical expenses for physical injuries or counseling related to the trauma of the event, sometimes funeral costs if there was a homicide, these are really traumatic times, and the financial toll that dealing with those treatment costs takes on low-income families is extreme, and so we appreciate the practical steps that this bill takes to make these benefits more available to low-income crime victims. It makes a big difference in people's lives to have a little bit of extra time to get their lives together, to submit an application, to be able to struggle to address the aftermath of post-conviction proceedings, we appreciate the effort, and there's nothing else I have to add. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Any questions for anyone on the panel? Ladies, thank you all.
I actually have a quick question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since I'm not familiar with how this process works, I'm just curious. I'm assuming, and for whoever, I'm assuming DOJ would answer this, but this the reimbursement for medical costs is just above and beyond if they haven't have insurance. Assuming it's what insurance is not picking up, or is it insurance claim is pending, or how does that work?
Chair Przanski,
limited amount of funds for this.
Yes, Chair Przanski, Senator Dienfelder, that is correct. We're the payer of last resort, so we only pay after insurance, including Oregon Health Plan, has paid. Sometimes if there's some kind of wrangling with the insurance companies, we might pay and then get paid back by the insurance company. But for the most part, it's after claims have been submitted. And then victims have either a copay or part of the bill that is not paid through insurance. Victims that don't have insurance, we then put the bills through a fee reduction schedule that we have worked out. And so we further reduce those in hospitals and medical providers, funeral homes have to accept that amount if they're going to accept payment from us, and that works usually very well.
Okay. And is this quick follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Source of funding, these restitution funds coming from the
offenders.
Restitution, or what is the source? I know we've talked about this in the past, but just a reminder.
Senator Przanski, Senator Dingfelter, members of the committee, there's a few different sources that feed into this program. One is criminal fine and assessment account funds that come from criminal fines and fees for Oregon criminals. The other is a 60% federal match that we received from the Federal Victim of Crime Act Fund, which comes from federal offenders. And then we also have some punitive damage money that we receive that kind of fills in the gaps where those two funds don't meet, and also restitution that we collect from offenders.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments?
I have a question now.
Yes.
That your answer raised a question for me. So is someone eligible for these funds if they are the victim of a crime that's considered a federal crime and prosecuted in federal court?
Chair Przanski, Senator Bonamici, members of the committee, if a crime occurred in Oregon, they're eligible.
Thank you.
It just has to occur in Oregon. It doesn't really matter where it's being prosecuted. They may also be eligible for some federal crime victims compensation, and then we'd work out who's the payer of last resort between the programs. But it just has to occur in Oregon, no matter where you're from.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you all again for coming forward. We're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on 3021 and go ahead and open up a work session on House Bill 3021A.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3021A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 3021A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So order, and Senator Bonamici will be our carrier. Thank you. And with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 3021A. And we have one other bill that was carried over yesterday to ensure that we got the remaining testimony. I'm going to go ahead and open up for the intent purposes of House Bill 2714A, only for the purpose, I know Sybil's here and she is one of two people, I believe she did not want to testify, and so she doesn't, so we'll close the public hearing, we'll open the work session on House Bill 2714A.
Mr. Chair, I move the -A3 amendment, excuse me, to House Bill 2714A.
Senator Cruz moves the -3 amendment to House Bill 2714A. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
I move House Bill 2714A as amended by the -3 amendment to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right. Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2714A as amended by the -3s to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered, Chair will carry the bill, and that concludes the work on the House bills. We'll close the work session on 2714A, and I believe that concludes the work for today. I'm looking around to make sure I've got all that correct. And tomorrow, I think we're scheduled to start at 9 because of conflicts. Is that...
That's what you said yesterday.
That's what I said yesterday, but we're going to confirm.
Let's see what's on the agenda.
I think I have a meeting from 8 to 9, if I'm not mistaken.
If you said it, we start at 9.
Well, we're going to see what Katie has up on the sheet.
9.
All right, so we will be back tomorrow, which is Cinco de Mayo, May 5th, at 9 a.m. Thank you. With that, we're adjourned for the day.